for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Centers for Disease Control announced new guidelines yesterday for travelers exposed to the Ebola virus. But governors of several states say they don't go far enough. They're leaving mandatory quarantines in place. Joining me to talk about the legal, ethical, and public health debate over Ebola quarantines, Michael Scheer of the New York Times, and constitutional scholar Bruce Fine. Joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York City, Donna Lieberman of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and by phone from his office in Bethesda, Maryland, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the National Institutes of Health. Do join us. Your questions, comments, 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you, Diane.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Good to be with you, Diane.
Dr. Fauci, tell us about these new CDC guidelines. What do they say? How different are they from current protocol?
Well, Diane, what they've done when it comes to people coming into the country from the involved West African countries is that they match the stratification of the risk to which the person entering the country has been in, be that a healthcare worker or perhaps someone from Liberia, Sierra Leone, taking care of or coming into contact with an Ebola patient. They match that stratification of risk with the degree and the intensity of the monitoring of that person after they arrive, and then they use that to make a determination as to what is the level of restriction that you would put on that person so that you have the fundamental scientific evidence and data dictate whether or not you're going to severely restrict someone or let someone go out without any issue.
But give me an example of what you mean. Are you talking about an accidental needle stick? What are you talking about?
Okay, so there are four fundamental risk categories, Diane. One is called a high risk, and an example of that is either a healthcare worker who has a needle stick or has a splash of bodily fluid from an infected person, or maybe not a healthcare worker, someone who's living with and caring for a person, or someone who's touched a dead body. That's one level of risk. The monitoring and restriction of that person is much more stringent than the next level, which is called some risk. Namely, you're in a country with widespread Ebola transmission, and even though you've had the right equipment on if you're a healthcare worker, but you've come into direct contact with that person, or you're not a healthcare worker and you have close contact with someone, you're put into the next one, which is called some risk. And then you go way down. The next is low but not zero risk. Namely, you just happen to be in the country that has Ebola transmission, but you don't have any known risk. And then there's something called low risk. So that's a new way of looking at things. Don't put everybody in the same bucket. Stratify them according to what their risk of him getting infected is, and match the kind of restriction and monitoring based on that risk.
All right. So say an individual has just come back from helping to care for other patients with Ebola. Would those individuals, if they were designated high risk, would they be banned from flying? Would they be banned from going to public places or getting on a bus? What would happen?
Well, it depends. If they're there, we're talking about, first of all, you have to distinguish, Diane, between a symptomatic person and an asymptomatic person. A person who's symptomatic, even if, let's say, pick out your high-risk person. Let's say it's someone that has gotten touched a dead body or living with a person caring. That person likely would not even get on the plane. What the American people are concerned about mostly is someone who gets on a plane, doesn't have any symptoms, and then gets here. What are we going to do with them? What kind of monitoring? So, for example, let's say someone who is a healthcare worker is in a country that has a high, widespread Ebola transmission, and they've had direct contact, and they've actually worn the right equipment. They're called some risk. That person would have, when they come here, direct active monitoring. So there would be not only just saying, I'm going to measure my own symptoms or temperature and I'll let you know. They're going to actually have someone directly every day come and make sure that person doesn't have symptoms and doesn't have a fever. And if they do, then that person would be restricted.
All right. So all of what you've just said still falls short of what the governors of several states want. Is that correct?
Well, when you talk about a quarantine, what you do is that you put sort of everyone in the same category and you quarantine them for 21 days. And what the CDC guidelines tries to do, and I believe successfully, is not put everyone in the same bucket of either complete restriction or no restriction.
And how do you feel about a mandatory quarantine?
Right. Well, first of all, I think it's important that I say this, Diane, because there's been a lot of, I think, a misrepresentation of opinions. The governors who've done that, I believe in good faith, have been trying to do what they feel is the best for their constituency. So there's no criticism there. There's nothing that I can say against them. The only thing I can say is that based on the scientific data and experience we have, that a person who doesn't have any symptoms is not going to transmit Ebola to anyone. The person needs to have contact directly with bodily fluids. And that's the reason why the CDC is doing the stratified risk and matching the kind of restriction to the risk in an asymptomatic person. If a person is symptomatic, there's no doubt they're not going anywhere. They're not going to be able to interact in the community. But I want to underscore, Diane, the idea we've got to get away from this criticism back and forth. I understand why governors may have done that. They're trying to do the best for their constituencies.
All right, Dan, that is Dr. Anthony Fauci of NIH. Turning to you, Michael Shear, how many states now have some kind of quarantine policy in place?
Well, so as the ones that we know of, there's about a half dozen that appear to have taken a kind of different or modified approach to what the CDC has done. So that you have, for example, in Virginia and Maryland, they both adopt a similar approach to CDC, but with some tweaks, so that they ask people to sign a document when they come in promising that they will not be going to mass events or places that are crowded.
Promising,
but not being, you know, sort of physically restrained or quarantined. You have New York and New Jersey who have said for that category that Dr. Fauci described of the some risk, those people would be mandatorily asked to stay at their homes. They would have somebody check in, a health worker check in with them twice a day, but unannounced, so a surprise visit so that you would be there. And the governor of New York has said, look, if they're not there, we're going to enforce the fact that they're there, although he hasn't said how they'll do that. You had the governor of Georgia yesterday say that the people in that that have direct contact with a patient, which would seem to be in that second some risk category for the CDC, those people would be quarantined in a government facility, though he didn't say what that government facility would be. And then you have the Army, which late yesterday announced that all of their soldiers that are going to be coming back are going to be quarantined on base with no access to their family members for 21 days. And that's irrespective of whether or not, as I understand, irrespective of whether or not they've been in touch with a patient or not. So a lot of those folks are just building hospitals and doing that kind of thing, and they're not actually caregivers. So there's been a kind of, you know, and largely it's a definitional thing, right? Like all of them are doing different things, but what's unclear, I think, to a lot of us, and I've been trying to follow this pretty closely for the last couple of weeks, is what is the definition? Which category do people fall in? And each governor is kind of taking a different approach. And, you know, what I think Dr. Fauci and others in the federal government have said is, look, we don't have the authority to mandate that all the states do what we want them to do, that ours are guidelines. Perhaps Dr. Fauci can talk about that a little bit some.
But tell me what the White House response has been to all of this.
Well, I think you heard Dr. Fauci at the end there talk about, we don't want to blame people. And I think there has been over the last couple of days, 24, 48 hours, a sort of backing off of what people perceived as this direct criticism. But I will tell you that my reporting suggests that the folks at the White House and in the administration since Saturday or Sunday after the governors of New York and New Jersey announced their policy, that there was a lot of concern, what I described in one of my articles as deep concern among the administration folks at how far New York and New Jersey had gone, and an effort to try to convince them to sort of pull back on that and come to a place that's more like what the CDC has proposed. I think there has been a lot of, in the last 24 hours, like, okay, let's calm down, let's not be in such a political fight. But at the end of the day, this is a difficult thing, and you saw Governor Christie and Governor Cuomo yesterday say, look, CDC can do what they want. We're going to protect our people, and that's going to cause some conflict.
And what about the reaction to the Joint Chiefs of the Staff in regard to the military?
It's interesting. That happened late last night, and I reached out to the White House and to Josh Earnest, the press secretary, and said, look, how do you square the fact that you've got the military doing one thing and the administration and CDC doing another? And he referred me back to the DOD and didn't want to say, so.
Michael Shear of the New York Times. When we come back, we'll talk about civil liberties, constitutional rights, lots of in-betweens. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I am talking here in the studio with Michael Shear of the New York Times, from whom you've just heard, and earlier with Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH. Also with us from New York is Donna Lieberman. She's executive director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, and constitutional scholar Bruce Fine. He is principal of Bruce Fine and Associates. Bruce Fine, are these quarantines that have been put in place by New York and New Jersey and other states considered legal?
I think the answer would be yes, based upon our existing framework of case law. The Supreme Court has repeatedly held you create a danger to yourself or to others, and someone with a contagious disease certainly does, can be restrained. And let me just give you some examples. Children can be required to be vaccinated to attend school so that they don't create risk to other students. The Supreme Court has held if you're a sex offender and you have a mentally abnormal condition that could be dangerous, you can be detained beyond your prison term. They've suggested in other cases that if you're mentally ill or a drug addiction or alcohol addiction, you could be detained and treated. indefinitely to try to cure your illness as long as it created a threat to yourself or to others. So it seemed to me in this situation, especially where, as Dr. Fauci said, those who are asymptomatic are the ones who are quarantined. That is, they have also have the symptoms that could be passed on to someone else that clearly would pass constitutional muster. And I think there are a couple of other elements that work in favor of legality here on the constitutional plane. One, you don't have a situation where a particular minority group is being singled out. You have sort of neutral criteria here. The length of the quarantine be 21 days, and it's not as though you're put in shackles. I'm not trying to understate the amount of irritation that comes with restraints on your liberty, but if you can't go to a ball game or to a concert or something, that's not as oppressive as if you're detained in a jail or something of that sort. And even with regard to non-liberty issues, with regard to if you have a diseased crop, it could be destroyed. If it threatens other diseased crops, a case called Miller against Shoney makes that clear. So I don't think this is a question of constitutional dimension. It's a policy question. And the last thing I'd say with regard to uniform federal standard, I think that if Congress wished, it certainly could empower the CDC to impose a national standard under the theory that the quarantines, if they're over-expansive, they could deter international travel and it could deter healthcare workers from traveling on their discretion. Now, unfortunately, the Congress is typically invertebrate on these issues. They think it's politically combustible, and so they run away and hide. And I don't think it makes sense, if anything. I think the conversation today would awaken anxiety in your listeners, because how can there be so many different protocols if they really know what they're doing?
And turning to you, Don Lieberman, did Governor Christie go too far in the quarantine of Nurse Casey Hickox?
Oh, yes, absolutely. But I want to return to the question of, you know, sort of whether the protocols in place, the quarantine policies in place generally, are in comport with the Constitution. I think that the policy of the CDC certainly does comport with the Constitution. As it turns out, good public health policy is good civil liberties policy because it matches the level of the restraint and the imposition on liberty with the level of the risk. But policies in place in New York and New Jersey, in fact, do not match the level of the restraint and the imposition on liberty with the level of the risk.
Why not?
Mr. Fine talks about, you know, the case law about people who are contagious being appropriately deprived of their freedom, detained to protect the rest of us. But people are being detained under these policies who don't pose a risk, who the CDC and all the public health experts tell us are not a threat to the public health. So while we understand that the governors are really trying to do the best, you know, and Governor Cuomo has said many, many times, better safe than sorry, you know, that's fine when it comes to shutting down the subways before Sandy. But it's not okay to go so far overboard and put people under the harshest quarantine conditions when we're dealing with people's liberty and when it doesn't serve a public good. I think that we have to talk about the collateral consequences of these sweeping quarantine policies, because it discourages health workers from doing the good, heroic work like Casey Hickox, even if they're confined in conditions that are not as abysmal and offensive and horrific as she was confined in. And they instill fear where we shouldn't be afraid.
Donna, I know that Dr. Fauci wants to get in, but I want to ask you one more question. Do you think that the governors have the legal right to place people in quarantines in their homes just to remain in their homes for 21 days?
I think that when people are contagious, then they can be quarantined. When people are not contagious, then I think that there are other measures that are fine that Dr. Fauci outlined that the governors can impose. But it can't be the most extreme level of restraint, which is quarantine. Public health doesn't call for it, but Dr. Fauci is a better person to talk about that than I am.
All right, Dr. Fauci, you're up.
Well, Diana, as Donna said, that's really the fundamental basis of what the CDC recommendations are, as I tried to articulate in the beginning of the program.
But they are confusing, Dr. Fauci. Suppose, let me just give you a what if. Suppose somebody gets on a plane declaring he or she has had no contact, no exposure, nothing, and arrives here in the United States and declares exactly the same thing, has no temperature. But suppose that person in private develops symptoms, goes to a bowling alley, and then throws up all over the place.
Okay. So, Diane, you can do a lot of what-ifs based on what-ifs based on what-ifs.
Sure.
You know, and that what you're asking for is a completely risk-free world. But putting that aside for a second, let me just say that when a person comes in, even if they deny that they have had contact, you're talking not about a healthcare worker. You're talking about just a normal person from Liberia or Sierra Leone. Now restraints are now that when someone gets off the plane, they are questioned and their temperature is taken.
Right.
So even if they're infected and still without symptoms, they now have active monitoring. So they have to report in now with their symptoms. They have to have their temperature taken each time, report it back in, and report on symptoms. If they don't do that, they have to give a contact information of where they are. They have to give us a telephone number, email address, where they're going to be geographically. And if they don't report in, that's called active monitoring, then they are subject to being restrained.
But couldn't they simply disappear into the population?
Diane, again, anything is possible like that. But you've got to really be careful if you do what if based on a what if based on a when if. You're going to make yourself tie yourself into a pretzel.
But you can't what an awful lot of people are beginning to do, Dr. Fauci, because the outlines, as you've put them, are somewhat hazy.
Okay. Well, Diane, let's just put a fact on the table. Since the beginning of this epidemic in March, two Americans have gotten infected in the United States.
Right.
Both of them have been taking care of a very drastically ill person, Mr. Duncan, who died.
Right.
Those were the only people who got infected. One more thing, Diane. Mr. Duncan was in the United States and was exposing himself to his family and others. None of those people have gotten infected.
Right.
That's what we're talking about, taking evidence-based and data, not a zero-zero risk, but look at what has happened.
All right, Bruce Fine.
Well, I think those points are well taken, but I think it's not unreasonable to not get an absolute risk-free system, but try to minimize that. And what I think the equation that's been discussed so far neglects is, what is the nature of the burden if you're in your home for 21 days? Is it really so drastic that that little extra increment of safety isn't worth it? Reasonable people can disagree, and to suggest that it's illegal or unconstitutional seems to me very flawed, because you identified, Diane, many of the places where the effort to monitor could fail because of dishonesty or otherwise. And maybe it's not even dishonesty, it's just inefficiency. That's part of what bureaucracies are about. When I came back from abroad, I'd traveled to Africa several weeks ago, I was just asked, well, did you come from Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea? And I did not, because I hadn't visited there, but that was the scope of the inquiry. Now, they may have increased it since that time, but I don't think that, for the reasons that you articulated, that it's unreasonable, again, indicating that the so-called home arrest, if you will, for 21 days is such a huge burden that an increment of public safety isn't justified.
Michael Scheer, how do you gauge the public reaction to what the CDC is saying and what the potential risks as outlined have been?
I mean, I think that's one of the things that we don't have a really clear picture about. I saw a poll coming in this morning that suggested that something like 54% of the people thought that they had confidence in the way the government was handling Ebola. So that would go, I think, to give some greater sense of confidence than I think you maybe pick up from the anecdotal watching the cable news shows. You would think that everybody's in a, you know, complete panic. I'm not sure that's the case. On the other hand, to your point that you made earlier, I do think people look at the patchwork of differences that are that have been, you know, that are out there. And they do wonder, given the sort of faith that they started with in the CDC as a sort of rock solid institution in the country, how come it seems so herky jerky? And I think from the beginning, and Dr. Fauci knows this a lot better than I, but, you know, when the Dallas situation started happening, there were all these questions that seemed to be the government seemed to be playing catch up. And I think that undermines a sense of confidence that the government is on top of this. And that's what I think the effort yesterday by putting out these national standards was about.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And Michael, we now have several different recommendations from obviously the CDC, several of the governors. They're conflicting to a certain degree. And what kind of a problem is this for the Obama administration?
Well, I think there's a couple of different levels on that. One is that I don't know that we want to get in down this rabbit hole, but there is an election in a week from today. And so there are all sorts of potential implications for how this has kind of dominated the conversation at a time when the Obama administration and the Democrats had, you know, would have liked to have been talking about something else. I do think, and it's a good question for Dr. Fauci, and I wonder, and this is a legal question that maybe the lawyers can talk about as well, but, you know, is there any way, short of asking Congress to pass new laws, that the government can encourage more of these states to adopt their policy? In other words, putting aside the fighting and the back and forth, I wonder if Dr. Fauci knows, is there an effort inside the White House, inside the administration, to try to sell this internally to all these other governors, to go to the governor of Governor Deal in Georgia and say, look, you know, you got to do it our way. This is really the better way, in the hopes of coming up with a more consistent package.
Dr. Fauci.
Well, the CDC is very, very much involved in interacting at the state level. The CDC is a federal organization that deals in a very collaborative way with the state and local health authorities. They can set a bar beneath which you can't go. The states can go over that, which we're seeing in some circumstances now. But in direct answer to the question, certainly the CDC is very actively reaching out with their partners at the state and local level, trying to get some sort of an agreement. Not necessarily everyone's going to agree, but to try and articulate why they feel that this matching of the stratification of risk and matching that with the kind of monitoring and restriction you ultimately do is something that's science-based and that will work. So direct answer, they are reaching out to the state.
So if the federal government comes up with some sort of executive protocol on Ebola, would that preempt what some of the states have done in terms of prescribing their own quarantines, Bruce Fine?
Well, I think that Congress clearly could empower the CDC to preempt the state laws. Now, the issue would be, Diane, whether under existing laws, if Congress does nothing, that an executive order is something that could be reasonably implied as authorized by the existing immigration legislation. I'm assuming the answer probably is no. Otherwise, it seems to me quite impolitic for President Obama to have this sort of Tower of Babel from all the different states outstanding, which create anxiety without a doubt, because the idea of the public would be if they know how to deal with this, there'd only be one protocol. You know, when you go and you get treated for a disease or a pneumonia, there's one protocol. They don't have 15 different ones. So my belief is that unless the president simply doesn't want to take on a federal burden where if there was a problem that's all, you know, on his shoulders, you couldn't assign it to the governor. I think probably it doesn't have the legal authority, the executive branch, to act now unilaterally.
Donna Lieberman, what about these so-called home quarantines? Are they okay, or do you feel they go too far in stepping on individual rights?
I think that quarantines at home are okay depending on the conditions. If they are extreme quarantines where people cannot leave their homes, cannot have family members with them or visitors, and they're asymptomatic, not contagious, then they don't serve the public health need. People
right.
need to be subjected to the least restrictive possible intrusions.
Donna Lieberman is executive director of the New York ACLU. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving to calculate baseline scores. More at Lumosity.com. By Inada, maker of the Dream Wave Massage Chair, with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at DreamWaveChair.com. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offer solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a longtime analyst argues that U.S. foreign policy blunders have created new feelings of vulnerability at home, our culture of fear, and how to move beyond it. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We're talking again about Ebola, this time the various quarantines put in place by certain governors. We have many callers, many emails. Here's an email from John in Missouri, who says it's better to be overcautious than too liberal with our measures. Otherwise, you can count on some misguided, self-centered person pushing the limits and infecting others in this country. How do you react to that, Bruce Fine?
Well, what I think it shows is that science is misplaced when it doesn't also incorporate how human beings can lie and misrepresent, and bureaucracies can become inefficient and not have a scheme come off exactly as you wish. And as we were pointing out earlier, the idea of self-reporting and monitoring and relating accurately the exposure is something that depends upon honesty and truth. And that is something we applaud, but surely that's not characteristic of everyone. And when we go back at the level of the danger, and plus I think, I think I'd agree with Donna, that, you know, home detaining for 21 days, given the fact that you're doing it in the public interest, is such an onerous burden, that these measures that are taken by the governors are provide an ample but not an unreasonable amount of comfort level.
Dr. Fauci.
Well, I think one of the things we have to put into the equation, and again, getting back to that, not in any criticism of anyone, because I believe everyone is trying to act in good faith for the best, for example, the governors, for the best of their constituents. But one of the issues, let's concentrate for a moment just on healthcare workers. So if you have a healthcare worker who goes over there at great sacrifice to themselves, remember, the best way to make Americans safe is to completely suppress this epidemic in West Africa. Then we don't have to worry about anything. The only way we're going to do that is by the kinds of resources that are being put in, of which volunteer healthcare workers are a major, major component of that effort. If they go over there, do everything right, at great sacrifice, putting themselves at risk, come back here and are without symptoms and are having direct active monitoring, which the new CDC guidelines call for. Direct means somebody takes their temperature. Somebody makes a clinical judgment whether they can go out into society. If they are not allowed to do that but have to be another 21 days out of commission, I know from talking to many of my colleagues, that would be a major disincentive for people to go over there and to do the kind of work that they're doing. And we need them. That's one of the considerations that you really have to put on the table.
All right. Let's open the phones first to Daytona Beach, Florida. Hello, Brandon. You're on the air.
Thank you for the great conversation, Diane.
Thank you. It
seems to me like what's not being recognized is that because this is so public and people are, I can't imagine someone traveling to and fro to West Africa, that being a small decision, depending on them to come in and reveal all the details of things that they may or may have not done, and then making a decision based on that doesn't account for the risk of them possibly misrepresenting something just to be able to get on with their lives. That's my comment.
Yeah. I think that's accurate, and I want to go back to another point that Dr. Fauci made, and I think I'd part company with him on how great a deterrent, you know, a 21-day house quarantine would be. The military unilaterally has done this, and I don't know whether people in the military are saying, well, I'm going to resign from the military because I've got 21 days quarantine if I'm gone to Africa. I think there's an understatement of the willingness of people in good faith to say, I'll take 21 days. You know, it's an irritant, yes, but, I can survive there. This is something that's needed to calm fears and as an extra precaution of risk. So this idea that no one would go to perform health care in Guinea or Sierra Leone or Liberia, I think, is vastly overstated.
Donna.
Yeah, I think, you know, easy for us to say. We're not subjected to this 21-day stay-at-home quarantine. It's not quite that onerous, and I think we have to understand and really respect what Dr. Fauci has said, which is that we're not saying that people should be just sent out into the world to go about their business. We're saying that anybody who is at a level of risk that warrants active monitoring is going to be actively monitored. So we're not saying go home and go, you know, touch everybody and shower with people or whatever people are going to do to create risk of infection. We're saying when you're asymptomatic, we're going to check on you every day, twice a day. There's nothing vague about that. There's nothing shedding responsibility for monitoring people. Yet you're not telling people you can't go out for a walk in the park. You're not telling them, and in New York City, you know, where you don't have a backyard, if you're quarantined in your house, you're quarantined sometimes in one room. It's like, you know, I guess it's solitary confinement, you know. And I think that, you know, fear is like we're all worried about the dangers from Ebola. But we have to listen to the medical experts, and we have to drive our policy based on the risk minimization that they are calling for. And I think that, you know, human life is complicated, and the situations that are going to arise are complex and complicated. We can't predict all of them. But what the CDC guidelines do is create levels of restrictions based on levels of risk, and there are responses that we can take as a society if somebody is non-compliant. That's what we did with TB, you know, and I think that it's what promises to work without imposing a terrible discouragement on healthcare workers. You know, are we going to start discouraging the EMT workers from dealing with people who might be infectious? Are we going to discourage the healthcare workers in our own country? You know, they take precautions, but what if? No, of course not. We need to be kind of reasonable about this, and I think respect the CDC right. guidelines, which, as I said before, respect civil liberties as
All
well.
Right. Here's an email from Deb Michael Scheer. She's in Ohio. She says, "Who's paying for the cost of these quarantines?" She says, "I know the parents of the journalist treated in Nebraska have said their son did not have any health insurance. His total costs were close to $500,000. Will he be responsible for that debt?"
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know the answer. There's a couple of different levels of costs, and perhaps Dr. Fauci knows how some of the insurance works. Clearly, there's going to be people with insurance and without insurance. The one issue, kind of side issue on cost, came up in New York City in terms of people's salaries. If you tell somebody that they have to quarantine themselves, as New York has done, at home for 2 or 3 weeks, what do you do to the people whose bosses say, well, then you're not going to get paid, right, for those 3 weeks? And the governor has said that they will make up the salary for those.
The state will.
Right. But that's a good question. If, you know, if this was a federal policy or if it extends to other states, you know, will other governors make that same choice? I don't know about the question on the insurance and who ends up paying for some of this highly specialized care, as Dr. Fauci provided to that nurse, the nurse farm.
Let's go to Miriam in Arlington, Virginia. Hi there.
Hi, Diane. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
First, for Dr. Fauci, my question, as a parent always protecting my children from disease, I know the first line of defense is the human skin. I understand that covering yourself entirely is what they're doing, but if the hands and the face are covered and there are no open wounds, then wouldn't a person, in essence, be protected after they took a shower? I'm just talking about for workers. That's just a technical question. On the other side, I really do believe that the CDC and the Department of Education should get together now. And in everyone's little trick-or-treat bag, we should be talking about exposures, and we should be talking about protection. And this could get us way ahead of what could come and get out of hand down the road.
But all right, Dr. Fauci. I'm sorry, Dr. Fauci, I'm not hearing you.
Sorry, Diane, I was on mute, so not
okay.
Okay. The answer to the question about protection, someone can be in a situation where they're taking care of someone who is seriously ill and they have the right personal protective equipment on and there's no real exposure that they know of. Sometimes because of fatigue or because of the stress of the situation, when they are in that environment, particularly in the West African country, that sometimes that when they take their material off, all of the protective material, they can sometimes accidentally contaminate their skin, which likely has happened on one or more occasion, and which is the reason why someone can't identify what the risk is. They haven't stuck themselves with a needle. They haven't got anything obviously on bare skin. It's likely something that has to do with when you, what's called doffing, when you take off your protective equipment. That's what we think happens in those situations.
All right, let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
It's a three-part question. First of all, with the new CDC regulations that have come out, what would have the nurses that have contracted this fallen under? And what will the caretakers fall under that are taking care of them now? And given that they were infected, have they pinpointed or do they have an idea of when that risk, when it was contracted? Do the two people that have it, do they have an idea of when and where they contracted it in the process of caring for them?
Well, the person that there were two nurses, one of whom I've had the privilege of taking care of, when they were first seeing Mr. Duncan, they clearly, first of all, didn't have the real drill type training. So they were at risk on the basis of a number of reasons. When she was finished taking care of the person, right now, having taken care of someone in that situation, she would have been on direct active monitoring when she was without symptoms. So at the time that she had no symptoms, someone would have been directly monitoring, taking her temperature, asking her about symptoms under the current guidelines. That's what we call direct active monitoring. Now, the situation is that once she got infected, that proves that the environment she in was a high-risk environment. So under those circumstances, if she had no symptoms, she would have had restriction of movement into crowded places, because even without symptoms, when you are in a high-risk situation, you have restriction of movement in addition to direct active monitoring. So if the guidelines had been in place at the time, that's what would have happened. And remember, those two nurses, to this point, have not infected anyone. The only two people, the only two Americans in this country who've gotten infected were those who put themselves knowingly at risk to take care of another human being.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Michael Shear, we have not heard one word from Ron Klain since he took over as Ebola czar. What explains his silence, and what is he doing?
Well, I think that's a good question that those of us in the White House press corps have asked repeatedly of the White House folks. They have said that while Mr. Klain has been in the past a sort of very sort of visible public person at times, that they envisioned his role as much more, in this case, much more behind the scenes as a coordinator person, somebody that would be at these meetings that I'm sure Dr. Fauci is part of, kind of coordinating all the different agencies and parts of government to make all of this work. You know, I assume that at some point, Mr. Klain may actually emerge as more visible public role. Let's remember, he just started last Wednesday, I think, officially. They announced him a few days earlier, but it takes a little time to get the clearances and all of that.
Do you understand clearly what he is supposed to do?
You know, I got to say, nothing about this story seems 100% clear to me. The best description that I've gotten is the comparison to the previous person who they said was coordinating all of this, which is Lisa Monaco, who is the president's Homeland Security advisor. And the best way it was explained to me was, look, she was trying to be the person, be the glue between all of these different agencies. But the problem was she had so many other responsibilities, taking care of the Yemen situation and all of Homeland Security efforts, terrorism here and abroad and ISIS and all of that. And it was just impossible for her to devote the kind of time. So that's what it's been described to me as.
And finally, to you, Bruce Fine, will so-called home quarantine stand up in court?
Yes, I think it clearly will. And I also want to make an observation about that. I do think that generally under the Constitution, when the government takes your property or opportunity to make income, they ordinarily play just compensation if the purpose of the taking is the public health or welfare. And I do think it makes a lot of sense in this circumstance where somebody, because they're under home quarantine, is deprived of the opportunity to work and losing money, that they may have a claim for just compensation if it's not voluntarily forthcoming.
And I think Dr. Fauci wants to make one last comment.
Yeah, Diane, please don't get confused about what Ron Klein's doing. He's playing a very active role. He is the Ebola response coordinator. There are multiple agencies involved, because just because you haven't seen him on television or on the airways. He's playing a very important coordinating role. And as was said correctly, that was formerly done by Lisa Monaco and to some extent Susan Rice. They have other very, very important day jobs, as you know. So what Ron is doing is something important and active. So just because you don't hear about it, that doesn't mean he's not actively involved.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, he joined us from his office at the NIH in Bethesda. Donna Lieberman, Executive Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Bruce Fine, constitutional scholar, author of Constitutional Peril, The Life and Death Struggle for Our Constitution and Democracy, and Michael Scheer, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Let's hope all of this simply quiets down. Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Diane.
Thanks so much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington, D.C. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Staples with